Something's missing now. I feel it all around. The laughter of his voice is gone, his warm and tender sound. The way he would strum and play and sing so sweet and high. Would you like to learn to dance? That always made me cry. I sing his tunes every now and then, just so you won't forget. A good friend is dead and gone, but his song ain't over yet. Back in my scuffling days, no bread, no job in sight, I sold my blood for a $5 bill just to see him at the quiet night. I sat through all the shows. I felt that he sang just to me. Little did I know back then his road of destiny. I sing his tunes every now and then, just so you won't forget. A good friend is dead and gone, but his song ain't over yet. He gave it all that he had, and he would have given more. You never met a tougher guy, and his songs you can't ignore. A kind word for everyone, a heart as big as the sky. You knew he had the real stuff when he looked you in the eye. I sing his tunes every now and then, just so you won't forget. A good friend is dead and gone, but his song ain't over yet. I sing his tunes every now and then, just so you won't forget. A good friend is dead and gone, but his song ain't over yet. His song ain't over.
Well, with the strains in the background of a beautiful piece of music that comes from a book that includes CDs, you just heard Song for Steve from a wonderful book written by Clay Eales, Facing the Music, The Story of Steve Goodman, if that's the full title. We're going to introduce him to you in a second, but I have to say something first. Clay Eales' book is so fascinating. I thought we have so many Steve Goodman fans out there. We may run a little long on this, and I promise the audience you'll hear the balance in a week to come, next week, of course, in the 4 p.m. hour, if we can't get it all in this hour. But let me add that we don't want to give the store away, so let's welcome right now Clay Eales to Traditions. Clay,
well, thank
welcome.
You, Bill. Thank you.
Well, let's talk about you. Well, first of all, let's talk about the song we just played. That comes as a CD with a book.
Well, yeah, it's one of 18 musical tracks. It's by Brian Gill, who is an ex-Chicago folkie, and the CD is songs that were written by and recorded by people in tribute to Steve after he died. And these were not commissioned for the book. These were tracks that I just discovered in the course of my exhaustive research for the book. Every once in a while somebody would say, well, you know, I have a track, or you ought to talk to somebody who recorded a track. And I thought, well, gee, I'll mention them in the last chapter of the book as evidence of how Goodman's music lives on. But then, you know, the total got to be up to more than 25, and I thought, man, I gotta somehow shed some light on this, and the best idea I could come up with was to have a CD that is inserted in the back of the book. And the real gift of this all is that all of the musicians contributed these tracks to the book for free. And I'm so grateful to them. And this music is all over the maps stylistically and tempo and whatever, but they all have the common thread of some significant mention of Goodman or a tribute to him, and certainly the theme of mortality. And it's really good music. I'm really fortunate to be able to give some attention to this stuff that people hasn't heard before. You know, it's just another example of how I'm just feeling gratitude these days. I mean, so many people helped with the book, and the music certainly supports it.
Well, people have helped with the book, but they've also loved Steve Goodman. Apparently, he had a wonderful following, not only amongst the public, but amongst his peers. Your book, by the way, is a little about 800 pages now. Let me tell you, those are 800 to the audience, not to you, obviously. 800 readable pages. You're going to find our stories in there. We're going to get into that. By the way, two performers you will not hear on this CD are John Prine, and the other one being Tom Paxton. I think, why don't you relate the story as why Prine has not got a tribute song and when it will come about. There's a reason for that, and it's in your book.
Well, he says he thinks he's got one inside him, but it just hasn't come out yet. He says that when he writes something for Goodman, he wants it to come from the gut, and he trusts his gut more than his head, and so he wants to wait until the inspiration strikes.
Well, good for him. And the other one, of course, is Tom Paxton, who you do print in the book, the lyrics, and I want to tell you, they are touching lyrics.
He wrote a poem to Steve Goodman, and Paxton gave me permission to print it in the book. It's a wonderful descriptive poem about Goodman, and then it ends up with kind of a very Goodman-like scatological last phrase. It's kind of fun.
I wonder, you think there's a song that might fit in here that we could play by Steve Goodman with the scatological phrase that we could actually air? What do you think? I don't know.
Oh, my. There are many.
There are many, yeah.
You know, Goodman was such a song crafter, and, you know, he really tried to make songs scan, and he could do the best romantic, social commentary, and funny songs, sometimes all at the same time. I mean, you know, probably the quintessential song of Steve that wraps up the kind of affectionate and commentary and funny and laughing at death is his really what many people who love baseball think is the best baseball song ever written. It's the Dying Cub Fan's Last Request.
You know what? I'll tell you what. We'll play that now. And it's interesting because there are Steve Goodman, I think you use the expression, there are Steve Goodman fans out there that don't even know they're Steve Goodman fans.
Oh, that's true.
And I have to, on a personal note, tell you, my daughter and son-in-law amongst them, because my son-in-law is a real baseball nut. And he has a compilation CD, and he thought it was all about baseball. There's one song, it's so great on here, he said. Some guy wrote, I don't know, Dying Cub Fan's Last Request. I said, well, you just discovered Steve Goodman also, you see?
That's right. You know, I was in Chicago in mid-May for the launch of the book, and I had been to Wrigley Field before, but this was the first opportunity I had to see a game there, and this was the Cubs and the White Sox, and given that the Cubs are not a contender, the Cubs-Sox series, the Cubs officials say, this is the Super Bowl for us, and you go there and every seat is filled, and people are screaming. My wife was 2 feet from me, and I couldn't hear her talking to me. It was so loud, and you know, as Goodman often said, he says that every once in a while, the Cubs screw up and they win. Well, they won that day, and you know what happens at Wrigley when they win? Immediately after the final out, rocking through the stadium is Steve's other Cubs song called Go Cubs Go, and everybody in the stadium is just singing it. You know, hey, Chicago, what do you say? The Cubs are going to win today.
That's just
and
great.
That song would not have come about if not for the Dying Cub Fan's Last Request.
That's great. Tell you what, let's play that right now, then. A Dying Cub Fan's Last Request.
By the shores of old Lake Michigan, where the hawk wind blows so cold, an old cub fan lay dying. In his midnight hour, the toll. Round his bed, his friends had all gathered. they knew his time was short. And on his head they put this bright blue cap from his all-time favorite sport. Told him it's late, it's getting dark in here, and I know it's time to go. But before I leave the lineup, boys, there's just one thing that I'd like to know. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy-covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave, the land of the free, and the doormat of the National League. Told his friends, you know the law of averages says anything will happen that can. That's what it says. But the last time the Cubs won a National League pennant was the year we dropped the bomb on Japan. The Cubs made me a criminal, sent me down a wayward path. They stole my youth from me, that's the truth. I'd forsake my teachers to go sit in the bleachers in flagrant truancy. And then one thing led to another, and soon I discovered alcohol, gambling, dope, football, hockey, lacrosse, tennis. But what do you expect when you raise up a young boy's hopes and then just crush him like so many paper beer cups, year after year after year, after year after year after year after year after year, till those hopes are just so much popcorn for the pigeons beneath the L tracks to eat. He said, you know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore before my eternal rest. So if you have your pencils and your scorecards ready, I'll read you my last request. He said, give me a doubleheader funeral in Wrigley Field on some sunny weekend day, no lights. Have the organ play the national anthem, and then a little na-na-na-na, hey, 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 goodbye. Make six bullpen pitchers carry my coffin, and six groundskeepers clear my path. Have the umpires bark me out at every base in all their holy wrath. It's a beautiful day for a funeral. Hey, Ernie, let's play too. Somebody go get Jack Brickhouse to come back and conduct just one more interview. Have the Cubbies run right out into the middle of the field. Have Keith Moreland drop a routine fly. Give everybody two bags of peanuts and a frosty malt, and I'll be ready to die. Build a big fire on home plate out of your Louisville Slugger baseball bats and toss my coffin in. Let my ashes blow in a beautiful snow from the prevailing 30-mile-an-hour southwest wind. When my last remains go flying over the left field wall, we'll bid the bleacher bums adieu. And I will come to my final resting place out on Waveland Avenue. The Dying Man's friends told him to cut it out. They said, stop it, that's an awful shame. He whispered, don't cry, we'll meet by and by near the Heavenly Hall of Fame. He said, I've got season's tickets to watch the Angels now, so it's just what I'm gonna do. He said, but you, the living, you're stuck here with the Cubs, so it's me that feels sorry for you. And he said, oh, play that Lonesome Losers tune. That's the one I like the best. Closed his eyes and slipped away. Scotty, it was the Dying Cub fans' last request, so here it is. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy cup with their ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only
You know, I tell you, besides the serious parts, and we're going to get to those, the City of New Orleans, which I guess you could call it a signature song, and so many others, he also did some great parodies. I love the one which you print a couple lines from in the book about the green, green grass of home.
Oh, my.
Well, I'll say the line. I love it. And there's the tree I used to pee on, the green, green grass of home. Great stuff. I mean,
he was, people know Steve for his songwriting, certainly. But in his very early days, he did a whole lot more of other people's songs in his performances. And he threw in songs of his own as he wrote them. But he really began as a covers artist, and he had an encyclopedic memory. He could pull songs out of a hat like anything. And like you say, on stage, he could twist them into funny parodies. And people just loved that about him. He was the epitome of an in-the-moment performer. I mean, he would say, I wouldn't have a set list for anything in the world. You know, he wanted to respond to the audience at a given time. And the Green Grass of Home that you're referring to is from a tape from the Flick in Florida. And it's one of a couple of hundred concert tapes that I have. Thank goodness for the people who recorded concerts, you know, with little tape recorders at their feet at shows, because they provided a lot of research material for me to be able to accurately describe Goodman's shows, and also to quote him, because he talked a lot between songs. And that's from an actual tape of him performing down in South Florida. Of course, South Florida was a huge influence on him. That it was there that he learned Michael Smith songs, and he had a long run at the Flick Coffee House, and also a little later Bubba's Coffee House, and one of the places that he was very popular.
I tell you, the book, as I said earlier to the audience, and we're talking to Clay Eales, the author of Facing the Music, The Life of Steve Goodman, and over 800 pages, and it has to be said, as I said earlier, readable ones. But you've gotten so much detail. Research this book. Well, let's talk about your book a little bit now. 8 years worth. That's a lot. But how did you get some of these amazing insights and bits of minutiae that you share with the audience or the readers?
Well, you know, I'm a journalist from way back. I worked for four newspapers for 15 years. I've taught journalism. I've been a publications editor. And you learn a lot in that time. And one of the things that you learn is the irony that the more in detail you go, the better a picture you can create in a reader's mind, and the more universal the sentiment becomes. Because with biography, to me, biography is the ultimate nonfiction, because then you can identify with the subject, and you know, you can say, what would I have done in that situation? And you can immerse yourself in the context, and it's just perfect for storytelling. And then you take a guy like Goodman. I mean, I'm so fortunate that I was able to pick him as a biography subject, because he was, I mean, if you go to the dictionary and look up the word gregarious, the word Steve Goodman would be right there. I mean, he connected with so many people. I think if there's a lesson in Goodman's life, it's that we're not meant to be isolated or hermits or whatever. We're supposed to connect with people and engage with people and inspire people. And what better way to do that than with the emotional language of music? And Goodman was just everywhere. And so, you know, as a journalist, I would interview people, and at the end of almost every interview, people would say, well, you got to talk to X, Y, and Z. And after a while, it fans out kind of like a chain letter, and you don't know where to end, because this guy just connected with so many people, and people were eager to talk with me about Goodman, and they had stories that were so vivid as if they were yesterday. And that's where a lot of the detail from the book comes from. Most of the people whom I talked with, you know, if Goodman had been alive today, he would be almost 59 years old. And so most of the people I talked with are of that, you know, 50s, early 60s age group. And, you know, in our, I'm 55, and, you know, in our 50s and 60s, we're a lot more reflective about our earlier life than we might have been when we were in our 20s and 30s. And so there's a real kind of a reflective glow about the interviews that are reflected in this book. And you know, Goodman, you know, a lot of people haven't had a real reason to think about Goodman over the last 20, 30 years. He died in 1984. And so when a guy comes along and says, tell me about Steve Goodman, it's sort of like a repressed emotion. Things just overflow from people. Some sources even cried when I interviewed them. They revered him so much. So it was just a matter of, you know, journalism's good shoe leather, right? So you just follow
That's
up your
true.
Leads and do what you can.
Well, that's the other thing I was curious about, two things I'll ask you. But you know what? As long as you're talking about metaphorical songs, why don't we play right now When My Rowboat Comes In?
Oh, my.
Because that sort of is, in a way, metaphorical.
Well, very much so. Yeah. You know, Goodman's earlier songs that invoked the symbol of the sun, that he was losing his race with the sun, and, of course, this is a reference to his leukemia. The beautiful thing about When My Rowboat Comes In is that he sort of reconciles this conflict within himself. It's not a very well-known song. It's on the second to the last album that he released during his lifetime. But it's a very comforting and joyful song about how, you know, when the sun comes out on the other side, everything will be all right. And I'm really glad you're going to play it, and I also used that as a way to end the book on a very peaceful tone.
It's interesting because, well, I guess we can call that a Steve Goodman gospel piece of his very own creation. Let's play it right now. When the my rowboat comes in.
On a stormy night when the clouds roll in, hide the lucky stars that I am under. And the smoky sky makes the heavens cry when the lightning strikes so long before the thunder. When the rain is done and I'm all alone, in the silence of the dawn that follows after, then I need someone who can find the sun and chase away my sorrow with her laughter. When my rowboat comes in, there'll be room enough to ride, though the seas are up in the highest tide. When the sun comes out on the other side, everything will be all right when we go rowing. As I find my way down this lonely road, with my old guitar as my one true companion, you can hear me play every song I know, from the mountains to the bottom of the canyon. Now they say the time is a precious jewel, I'm looking for some moments I can borrow. If my lucky stars won't shine tonight, I'd rather take my chances on tomorrow. When my rowboat comes in, there'll be room enough to ride, though the seas are up in the highest tide. When the sun comes out on the other side, everything will be all right when we go rowing. When my rowboat comes in, there'll be room enough to ride, though the seas are rough in the highest tide. When the sun comes out on the other side, Everything will be all right when we go rolling.
Steve Goodman. That's interesting. Which brings me to the other question. And feel free not to answer this if you want to. You give a lot of credits for people who you interviewed. And I didn't tell the audience. You interviewed over 1,000 people.
That's right.
Something like that. But the immediate family of Steve Goodman, mother, I believe, brother, I believe, and wife did not want to be interviewed. Yet you wrote some wonderful things about them. Do you have any reason that they didn't want to talk about it?
Well, it's hard to know. You can't crawl inside somebody's head. You just have to respect their reasons, whether they tell them to you or not. And I don't have a chapter and verse on why his mom, his brother, and his widow, who has now been remarried for more than 15 years and has a wholly new life, why they declined to be interviewed for the book. But they are far from absent from the book, as you note. I tried to get them in there whenever I could. You can't tell Steve Goodman's story without them.
And his mother comes across as a really wonderful, warm human being.
Yeah.
And Bud, too, the father, right.
I guess, to get at the core of your question, if you think about, I mean, we all have people like this in our lives. If somebody is very close to you, let's say, and then somebody comes along and says, and they don't have to be no longer living, just somebody very, very close to you, maybe your spouse, maybe your child, maybe your sibling, maybe somebody comes along and says, I want to do a book on this person. The people closest to that subject may be the last ones to pull down their defenses and talk about some very personal things. And so I think that may be what happened. And also just consider the fact that Goodman's life, although he was an incredibly joyful human being and people revered him, he had a tough life. And for those closest to him, dealing with the death sentence that was over his head his entire adult life had to be an incredibly difficult ordeal. And sometimes you just don't want to go back to that kind of thing.
Well,
so
yeah,
I can certainly understand and respect, but the wonderful thing about this book, though, is that 99% of the people I approached to talk with about Goodman, including some members of his family, including his oldest daughter Jessie, said sure, and I spent hours with them, and they were eager to talk, and so I do believe this is a as complete a portrait of Goodman as we can get, I was able to dig up.
I don't think one can get a more complete one at all. As a matter of fact, there's one tale, without giving the story away here, which reminded me actually of an old Shelley Berman routine, which is very touching. But you tell the story about how he wants to go to New York.
Right.
And I believe it was his father. Maybe it was his mother, but I think it was his father who said, well, you know, whatever, but, you know, if it doesn't work out, they'll always have a place back here in Chicago. Well, Shelley Berman has a whole very funny routine about the Jewish delicatessen owner. His son wants to be an actor fella, he said, you want to be an actor fella? And he says, but at the very end, after he's trying to dissuade him, I said, well, you know, if you don't make it, there's always a place for you here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it's basically the same routine, but only this was very serious, of course.
That's
and they
true.
Supported
and,
him.
And his parents, Steve was groomed to be a doctor.
Yes.
And Steve was the farthest thing from a doctor that you could imagine. I mean, he was incredibly bright, and he scored high on any academic tests he had, but he just wasn't cut out to be a doctor. And music was the thing that really fueled him. And like so many people in our the baby boom generation, there was that conflict between you and your parents and whether you were going to do what your parents wanted you to do or whether you really felt in your heart you wanted to do. And eventually, particularly with the leukemia diagnosis, Steve shed any notion of going on to any kind of academia and just plunged full scale into music. Followed his heart.
And as long as we're talking about the music, it's interesting. He ran the gamut, the spectrum of different styles and different musicians. When you talked before about him being on the stage and always talking in between his sets and telling stories, sort of an Al Jolson, you might say, almost the complete performer.
That's a great comparison. He revered Al Jolson. One of the things that Goodman did at the time, I mean, take yourself back to the late 60s, early 70s. One of the catchphrases of that time was, don't trust anybody over 30, right?
Right, right.
Well, Goodman embraced them. I mean, he was like a musical sponge. He soaked up everything he heard on the radio, and he didn't listen to just one station in Chicago, which is sort of like a melting pot of musical styles. He soaked up everything and had this, what one person called a phonographic memory, and he just loved all kinds of music. One source in the book, Ed Holstein, says, I don't think there was a song out there that Goodman didn't like. And so he not only revered these styles of music, but he also wanted to find out where a performer got his influence and then where that performer got his influence. And it took him back to performers from the early part of the 20th century. I mean, Al Jolson certainly was one of those, and Goodman himself emulated Jolson even visually, sometimes showing up at the Earl of Old Town on New Year's Eve with a tuxedo and top hat. There are times on stage when he would get down on one knee and sing Mammy.
Really?
And then just in his own musical milieu, he embraced the older performers, this three-member African-American string band called Martin, Bogan, and Armstrong, who had played as the Tennessee Chocolate Drops in the 1920s. He sort of brought them back to life. When the duo of Homer and Jethro, when Homer died and Jethro, the ace mandolinist, was sort of cast adrift, Goodman sort of saved Jethro's career, and Jethro became kind of a father figure to Goodman, particularly after Goodman's own father died. This kind of embracing of the older generation didn't go on a whole lot, at least in sort of the mainstream pop culture of the 1970s, but Goodman was doing that all the time.
Well, as long as we're talking about Jethro Burns right now, which is the other part of Homer and Jethro, they became very good friends, and certainly musically together appeared so many times. Let's play a piece that features him right now, Jethro Burns. Trying to think which one would be a good one to pick for that. We'll pick one, and we'll play it, and then we can talk about it afterwards.
I met Steve in 1970, and since then, why, I worked with him God knows how many times. One of the greatest things that happened during that time was I was out on the road playing some of the little dates that I played all by myself. My wife called me one time and she says, I just booked you on a tour with Steve Goodman. I said, you can't do that. She said, I did. I said, where am I going? And she says, well, he just gave me a few of the dates, but there's 76 of them in all. I said, honey, I have dates of my own. She says, not like this, you ain't. So it started a relationship with this young fella that was so great that I worked with a partner of mine for 39 years, which was very, very wonderful. But the short 10 or 12 years I worked with Goodman was even more so, because this guy... You say God, but if I would say God to Steve Goodman, I would give Goodman top billing. And if that's sacrilegious, I don't really give a damn. This first tune is dedicated to one of my ex-wives. It's called The Lady is a Tramp.
Jethro Burns, there he was. And the, another piece that always broke me up, and there's a great story in your book about it, is the how he worked so hard to learn the words to The Auctioneer.
Oh, yes. You know, this really goes to the core of Goodman's drive to be a stage entertainer. If you know the song The Auctioneer, it's a lightning-fast double-talk song that imitates the patter of an auctioneer, and it's written by Leroy Van Dyke. Well, Goodman not only heard it in concert when he went to New York City, but he brought back a record to Chicago, and he was determined to learn it. And so most people these days don't have a turntable, much less remember this aspect of a turntable. But when you had an LP, there was you would be able to play it at its regular speed of 33. But on many turntables, you could also play it at half speed, which was 16 RPM and revolutions per minute. And so Steve, over and over and over, and he drove his roommate nuts doing this, played The Auctioneer at half speed at 16 so that he could learn the exact patter of the Auctioneer song. And if you hear the many recordings of Goodman doing The Auctioneer, later on, he got it down note perfect. He got it down word perfect. And it just flowed out of him as if it were like breathing.
It's an amazing piece of work. In fact, you know what? We'll play that right now. Steve Goodman doing The Auctioneer.
Well, this is an old Leroy Van Dyke country and western song. I learned it off the record. I slowed it down and wrote the words down. And... thank you. Now there was a boy in Arkansas, wouldn't listen to his ma, and she told him that he ought to go to school. He'd sneak away in the afternoon, take a little walk, and pretty soon you'd find him at the local auction barn. He'd sit and listen carefully, and pretty soon they began to see how the auctioneer could talk so rapidly. He said, oh, my steward, I gotta learn that auction. I gotta make my mark and be an auctioneer. $25 bidder now, $30, 30, 50, give me 30, make it 30, the middle of all, $30, will you give me 30, and who'd have been a $30 bid? $30 bidder now, 35, will you give me 35, I'll make it 35, minute of 35, and who would have been a $35 bid? On and he didn't rest, and everybody saw that he didn't jest. He practiced calling bids every night and day. His daddy could find him out behind the bars with the working up and off the storm. He tried to imitate the auctioneer. Then Dad said, son, we can't stand have a mediocre man selling things at auction using our good name. I'll send you off to the auction school, and then you'll be nobody's fool, and you can take your place among the best. $35 bidder now, $40, 40, 50, give me 40, make it 40, bidder of all, $40, 50, give me 40, and who would have been a $40 bid? $40 bidder now, 45, 50, give me 45, make it 45, bidder of 45, and who would have been at a $45 bid? From that boy that went to school, there grew a man who played it cool, and he came home a full-fledged auctioneer. And the people came from miles around just to hear him make that rhythmic sound that filled their hearts with such a happy cheer. His fame spread out from shore to shore, and he had all he could do and more, and he had to buy a plane to get around. Oh, he was the best in all the land, and everybody gave that sucker a hand, and he was the best hillbilly auctioneer. $40 bidder now, $50, 50, 50, give me 50, make a 50, bidder revolve, $50, bidder, give me 50, and who'd have been a $50 bid? $50 bidder now, $55, bidder, give me 55, make a 55, bidder, 55, sold that hog for a 50, I sold that hog for a 50, I sold that hog for a $50 bid.
Right. I've always loved that particular song. But again, as we talked of earlier, and we'll talk about in a few minutes some more about the various clubs he performed, that he ran the spectrum of as I said earlier, of artists, Pete Seeger, Harry Chapin, John Prine, and that he was close to. And then Paul Anka. Now, there's an interesting part of the book.
Well, you know, Paul was sort of a teen idol in the late 1950s with Diana and Put Your Head on My Shoulder, and this was almost a musical generation ahead of Goodman, and when Goodman was coming up, Anka had already sort of gone Las Vegas on us all. He had written the theme for The Tonight Show, he had written Sinatra's signature song, My Way. And, you know, that Paul Anka would have anything to do with Steve Goodman is just a real head shaker. You wonder, how did this happen? Well, Steve was performing as the local act, opening act for Kris Kristofferson at a small club in Chicago, The Quiet Night. And Kristofferson flew into Chicago on the same plane as Paul Anka, just coincidentally. And Kristofferson was the definition of hot at the time. This is the spring of 1971. His songs were being recorded and played on the radio by many others. In fact, Janis Joplin's Me and Bobby McGee at the time was just inescapable, and that was a Kristofferson song. And one of Kristofferson's songs that had sort of broken through was Help Me Make It Through the Night, very romantic song. And Paul Anka was doing that song in his act, and Paul Anka was playing the really posh Palmer House in Chicago at the same time as Kristofferson was at The Quiet Night. Well, they were talking to each other on the airplane, and Anka said, I want to thank you for this part of my show. And he decided to come to Kristofferson's, you know, one of his third sets at The Quiet Night, comes bounding up the steps, and ends up on stage in his tuxedo singing Help Me Make It Through the Night, and he invited the whole troupe to a very late night, early morning breakfast at his suite at the Palmer House, and, you know, this huge outlay of food, and they're sitting around eating, and Christofferson tells Goodman, hey, get out your guitar, and would you like to learn to dance? And it was sort of like an audition for Paul Anka, who had not heard Goodman before. And Goodman plays the song, and Paul Anka, the first thing he says is, how would you like a plane ticket to New York? In other words, I'm going to give you a chance to record a demo, meet some record industry people. So how would you like a plane ticket to New York? Goodman's first response is, how would you like to see the short, fat Jewish kid dive into the vat of chicken Kiev?
And that was a funny, great story, isn't that?
And but as it goes further, because this is the quintessential story of Goodman's musical generosity. I mean, it was hard to get Goodman to talk about himself. He would be putting across the case of so many other entertainers, and you know, 99% of us, if we were asked the question that Paul Anka asked us, how would you like a plane ticket to New York? We would say, gee, sure. Thank you so very much, Mr. Anka. That's
I'm
a
on the
great
plane
idea.
Already.
You know, I got to go call my wife. I'm so happy. I'm so thrilled. But you know what Goodman said? He said, well, if you think I'm good, you got to see my friend John Prine. And so the next night, the whole troupe goes down to the Earl of Old Town late, and they hear Prine. And Anka ends up giving them two plane tickets, one for Goodman and one for Prine. And the ultimate irony there is that Prine was considered the new Dylan, and he went on to more success than Goodman ever had. But this is all because of Goodman's generosity and, you know, the quirk of fate of Paul Anka being there at the same time.
Well, but there, of course, one can argue the point, too, that Steve didn't live long enough to possibly become as famous or as widely known as John Prine, possibly. I mean, I don't know.
Well, it's one of those what-if kind
of
things.
Yeah, of course.
But
the generosity,
right from the get-go, later that year when they both got record contracts, it was very clear that Prine was doing much better than Goodman. In fact, Goodman himself compared, you know, if you remember that old TV show, Wild Bill Hickok, and he always had this sidekick.
Andy Devine,
Andy Devine, and he'd always be running behind Wild Bill saying, wait up for me, Wild Bill. And Goodman saw himself like that character, that Andy Devine character, wait up for me, John Prine.
Yet he kept the friendship going, which I think is a marvelous thing. And of
course,
later on, you could write a whole other book about how they had recording contracts and how John Prine ended up with his own recording company and for what reasons, but there's no point going into that here. And we don't want to give the whole story away. Some of the great stories you have, you let people read that in your book, which, to remind everyone, is a book by Clay Eales, who's with us today, and it's called Facing the Music, The Life of Steve Goodman, if I've paraphrased that properly. And, by the way, just to digress for 1 minute, to get the book, I'm sure you can order it in your favorite bookstore. Mm-hmm. Is there a website, too, where one can go?
Oh, sure. I have a website, and it's just my name, clayeales.com, C-L-A-Y-E-A-L-S. And people have been asking me, well, gee, can I get an autographed copy of the book? And I'd love to do it, but it weighs 4 pounds, and it's just insane to mail it two or three different ways in the mail. So
yeah, and you
if
never,
you get it through my site, I can send you an autographed postcard.
That's very nice of you.
That ends up being like a bookmark, and it's not quite the same as a signature in the book, but that way we stay all sane.
Yeah, and you never even put in your book my great testimonial to your book. I have to buy a jockstrap so I can carry it. So, you know, it's
well, you know, I actually had this is true. A guy called me last fall and he said, you know, most people want to write a book that you can't put down, but you've written a book that you can't pick up.
that's very good. That's a much nicer way of putting it than I did, that's for sure. I have to say that. There's one story I have to relate to you, by the way, having to do with the Dylan part you talked about. It's on page 252 of your book, where you, and then I want to ask you a question about the book again, but in that page, you talk about the party that Christofferson threw, and there were many people there, including Dylan. And I think it was he who debuted a new song he had written. Right now, it escapes me the title of the song. You'll fill me in, I'm sure. At which point, now again, Steve Goodman, he was not anybody of any great fame at this point. And when asked,
well, this was in Carly Simon's Manhattan apartment.
Right.
And this was quite an assortment of people, not only Goodman and Prine and Christofferson, but Bob Dylan showed up.
Right.
And it was what they call a guitar pull, where they just pass a guitar around, and everybody plays a song or two. And, you know, as Goodman said, it was like, auditioning for God.
That was the point of my story. And he told
Dylan,
him he did, yeah.
Dylan plays the song you're talking about is George Jackson.
Yeah, George Jackson. And Steve Goodman says to him, though, you quote him as saying, "It's no Masters of War." And I thought to myself at that point, they seemed to be friendly, even went on a motorcycle after that. He came up a little better than Phil Oakes when he criticized Dylan, who threw him out of his limousine.
Well, you know, Goodman was pretty plain-spoken and also just had this disarming smile and big brown eyes. And
yeah.
And even when he was being blunt like that, you just couldn't help but love the guy. I'm sure that, I mean, there are several other Dylan-related stories in the book. Dylan actually recorded with Goodman on a couple of tracks, and they apparently had a good, very good professional relationship. Dylan had a very high regard for City of New Orleans, for instance.
Why I was surprised when I read that, because, as I said, Phil Oakes, but I guess he felt him more of a competitor, possibly, because of the politics. I'm not sure. But as I said, the story goes in an interview that Phil Oakes gave, actually, not to me, it was an interview that I have, where he tells a story where he's in a limousine with Dylan and Ben Blue, I believe it was, and he criticized a particular song. I don't know which one it was now. And Dylan says, "Just get out of here. You're a reporter. You're not a songwriter."
Well, the thing is, Dylan came on the scene about 10 years before Goodman, so there may be a bit of the sort of mentor-protege relationship there as well.
This interview is proving to be so fascinating. I'm sure you're all feeling the same thing as I am. So we're going to take a break right now due to time limitations on the program. And we will do the second half of this interview next week. I'm sure you do not want to miss that. You'll be hearing stories about some John Prine songs, and you'll be hearing some of them. You'll be hearing, of course, the classic. We're saving that one for the end, and you know what the classic is. I'm not going to repeat that right now. We'll be hearing from the Artistic Hair album, and also, we start with the story we told earlier. We never got to play the song. We start next week with Would You Like to Learn to Dance? Clay Eales, as I said, is our guest. Clay Eales, the author of Steve Goodman, Facing the Music. So please do join us next week. You don't want to miss the end of it. And now we'll do a little bit of music to bring us to the top of the hour. And after that, I'll see you on the other side of the top of the hour. Oh, and one other thought I should pass on to you, that if you missed, or you can tell your friends if they missed this interview, it will be archived on Clay Eales' website, which he gave you earlier, which I believe is Clay Eales, EALS.com. And there you can listen to this interview, and then next week after that, you can hear the second half if you are not able to hear it right here live or streaming on the web. All right, let's get to some music now.